You're listening to Radio Catskill.
From WJFF in Jeffersonville, this is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, Dr. Jim Lomax is in the house with a COVID-19 update. We're not out of the woods yet. Plus, Leif Johansson joins us with an excerpt on his latest podcast, Close to Home. He's talking trash. And we'll check in with Bethel Woods and their latest way to connect the community with their Sensory Memory Museum exhibition for folks with autism. That's all coming up. And you can donate during our spring fund drive. Go to WJFFradio.org. Show your support for public radio for the Catskills in Northeast Pennsylvania. First, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. The second week of testimony in the trial of the former Minneapolis police officer charged in the death of George Floyd wrapped up yesterday. The prosecution spent the week questioning numerous health experts, including the medical examiner who performed Floyd's autopsy. NPR's Martin Costi has been following the trial.
This week is more about the analysis of what happened, first from the point of view of the rules that govern how police may use force, and then from the point of view of medical science. The culmination of the week may have been yesterday afternoon when the Hennepin County medical examiner Andrew Baker restated his official finding that Floyd's death was homicide.
NPR's Martin Costi reporting. President Biden has announced the creation of a commission to examine proposals for changing the Supreme Court, its membership, and its tenure. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports some Democrats have been calling for expanding the number of justices to counteract the court's conservative shift during the Trump administration.
The size of the commission, a whopping 36 members, and its mandate not to produce actual recommendations telegraph that the eventual report could end up on the ash heap of history. The commission's mandate is to examine, among other things, whether the number of Supreme Court justices should be expanded, whether there should be limits on how long a justice can serve or age limits, and even whether there can or should be changes to the nomination and confirmation process, which in recent years has been altered significantly. But the commission is specifically not charged with making actual recommendations. Rather, it has 180 days to produce a comprehensive report exploring the issues. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
The U.S. economy is starting to emerge from the coronavirus pandemic, but American women, already hit disproportionately hard, are being left behind. NPR's Amy Held reports the vice president will speak at a summit today addressing a key factor behind women in the workforce, caregiving.
Vice President Kamala Harris and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi are among today's speakers at a virtual summit called Care Can't Wait, focusing on investment in an industry overwhelmingly carried by women. New COVID relief provides tens of billions of dollars for child care providers, but the nation's long-standing caregiving inequities have only been worsened in the pandemic. Many low-wage child care jobs held overwhelmingly by women of color vanishing in the last year. And as COVID closed schools, other women leaving the labor market to take on caregiving roles at home. Today, the women's labor force participation rate remains at a low. A new White House infrastructure plan is calling for more investment in the caregiving industry. Amy Held, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
My name is Sarah Banks, and I am a part of Foster Supply Hospitality, a local business and proud underwriter of WJFF. We can't thank you guys enough for all the wonderful work that you do. And truthfully, as a business, we want to thank all the passionate and wonderful volunteers that work to keep you guys on the air 24 hours a day and 365 days of the year. You guys are critical partners in our mission at Foster Supply to support this area and its continuous growth, and we're thrilled to support it. And you guys help me stay connected. Free, it's accessible, and people who might not have the opportunity to get information are able to do so.
Your engagement and support are essential to what we do. Make your contribution now at wjffradio.org. Thanks. We are Radio Catskill, your NPR station for the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania.
WJFF has been talking to people on air about so many important things. You may have missed what they're saying about us.
I love JFF.
I tip my hat to all of you at WJFF.
I'm so happy to just make a plug for contributing to WJFF. We need you more than ever.
Now we just need to hear from you at WJFFradio.org. Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Sony Pictures Classics, presenting The Father, a new dramatic thriller directed by Florian Zeller, starring Anthony Hopkins and Olivia Colman, about a man's reality unraveling in the presence of his daughter. Now playing. Good morning. This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. And this morning, we've got a special Spring Fun Drive edition of Radio Chatskill. Joined on the phone now by our own Leif Johansson, who hosts the podcast Close to Home at WJFF. Good morning, Leif.
Good morning, Tim. Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for coming on, and thanks for helping be my pitch buddy. We are bringing you some of the program, the programming that we normally bring during Radio Chatskill, deeper dives into some of the topics of the week. We're going to talk to Dr. Jim Lomax about the COVID-19 latest numbers locally and then some of the national trends in just a second. And then we're going to get to your podcast, an excerpt of your latest podcast. A little bit later on, but just wanted to remind folks that it's our Spring Fun Drive, and you can donate at wjffradio.org if you support the local programming that you're hearing now, or Leif's podcast as well, which is on wjffradio.org. So while you're there, you can donate and then go listen to the podcast, right?
Absolutely. And you know what? It takes between, not just speaking for my podcast, but all of the local news and volunteer work and hours of work that goes into bringing you all of this stuff, whether it's local COVID updates or music shows or the local edition or anything in between. It takes hours and hours of volunteer work to make this stuff come to life, even though it sounds like it just kind of rolls nice and smooth on the radio. There's a lot of behind the scenes work that goes into it. So if you appreciate all that work, show your support. You can go to wjffradio.org and make your contribution today.
That's right, wjffradio.org. And one of the things we've been doing on Radio Chatskill is talking to doctors and others, experts about the pandemic. And our very own Dr. Jim Lomax joins us today to give us the latest on the COVID-19 epidemic locally. There's a key coronavirus model that's projecting more than 618,000 deaths in the United States by August. There are surges in the country, in Michigan, and also it looks like Sullivan County is not quite out of the woods.
Sullivan County seems to be kind of on the quiet side compared to other places, but if you really take a close look at the statistics, we are not at a good spot right now in our current way of immunizations and also the number of people who are still getting sick. In fact, we're actually rated as a very high-risk county in the United States. Currently, we have about 35 to 37 new cases daily. That's as of yesterday. But if you put it into population, Sullivan County has a 46.8 per 100,000 population rate, and that's equivalent to Kings County, New York County, the Bronx. So we're not, even though the numbers seem small and the number of deaths have been very low, we still have a very high rate of new cases being reported on a regular basis.
And it looks like the cases in the United States overall are trending upward as well. Is that
true?
A result of some people just not paying attention, or is it more about people thinking things are getting better and not taking precaution?
I think you can probably put in another half dozen reasons. The other thing, I heard something very interesting this morning on television, and this was an epidemiologist, a virologist specialist, and he said basically, you know, the misnomer is, you know, COVID-19. Well, the COVID-19 really should be called COVID-21 now, year 1921, because the organism is very different than it was when it first started. So that's very high and very easy spread of the infection itself. And it's not any more benign. In fact, it might be in more dangerous in terms of not so much killing people, but leaving long-term health effects after someone gets sick with COVID. So it's the field is changing. But there's a lot of reasons that, you know, also people are refusing, there's a number of groups who are still refusing to get immunizations regardless. And that's difficult. I think the epidemiologists also say that we're going to have to, in order for us to get to herd immunity, we have to make sure we're going to be immunizing children and young adults at a higher rate than we are right now, in order to get that where there is a certain amount of protection of spread. So there's a lot of things going on that is not necessarily good.
Even though there are increasing amounts of people being vaccinated, right. It still only accounts for 20% of the U.S. population. So we're not quite there.
Something to the rate we're about, as far as Sullivan County is concerned, about 29% of people have had at least their first dose in the county, and that should be much higher. But, of course, there's been lots of reasons for it. There's been problems with availability. That seems to be getting improving. We're now opening up our larger vaccine sites. Pharmacies now have a vaccine available. So now I assume after May 1st, if the president is true to his word, everyone is going to be eligible for it. But there's still going to still be a number of people, and perhaps as many as 50% of the population is not going to want to get a vaccine. So then you're going to have looking at a situation where this virus just continues to mutate and kind of like meanders through the population looking for someone that they can infect. So it's not a good situation at the moment.
It's already mutated, and some of the variant strains detected overseas are here. In fact, the strain detected in Britain has become the dominant strain in the United States, and the Brazilian variant is the number two strain in the United States. How are these variants defining the next phase of the pandemic?
Well, it's a race. How many people, how many needles and arms can you get so that people have a certain amount of protection against these infections. Fortunately, all these mutations seem to be affected by the vaccine itself, but it's going to be get to the point that that's going to escape too. So it's really right now a race who's going to get it, whether you're going to get sick or whether you're going to get vaccinated. So it's a real challenge for public health in this county and every other county in the United States. But again, Sullivan County is rated as a very high-risk county in the country. Mm-hmm. So it's just because our numbers are smaller, the number of deaths are not as high as other places. We're still just about the same shape we were back when we had the spikes in November, January, and February.
Do we know what accounts for some of that higher rate of infection or higher risk for Sullivan County?
I'm not enough of an expert to explain it to you, but it still has to do with those spike proteins. And so there's variations in the spike proteins, and that allows them to attach to cells and infect the cells themselves. So when you talk about it, it's really not the coronavirus itself is the same, but the spike proteins are changing. And again, if they can penetrate better, into cells, they're going to be doing that and infecting the individual.
At the end of March, Sullivan County Public Health issued that advisory that we still need to remain vigilant because COVID is still on the rise. I thought what was interesting in that press release from Public Health Director Nancy McGraw was that because we hadn't achieved herd immunity, that they're urging everyone, whether they were vaccinated yet or not, to continue wearing masks, socially distant, washing hands regularly, and staying away from close gatherings with people they don't see daily or who are not yet fully vaccinated. Do you think that because there's because of the pent-up frustration of so many in the population over the last year, if they've gotten vaccinated, that they're just out, I got to go, I'm fine, but maybe not being aware of how it impacts the rest of the community?
Well, that could be part of it. Some of it is, basically people are so tired, the fatigue factor. I think we're all tired of wearing masks and spacing ourselves and, again, working at home sometimes, although that might be a trend going forward. But the use of masks is the one thing that probably varies the most, depending where you're at. But people, if they're in a public setting, have to wear a mask. That's the number one thing. Same with travel. It's starting to kick up now. But again, it should be avoided unless you've had, unless you're fully vaccinated. And a lot of people are flying who were not fully vaccinated or didn't get any vaccination. And then indoor gatherings, the same way. Again, you can be with other people who have been vaccinated and have at least, and then waited the 2 weeks after the vaccination to get full protection. But again, outdoor events, you still need to wear masks, public places. Same with schools. Schools is going to be a very interesting issue in terms of we're going to be probably giving children and young adults immunizations in the fall. But again, there's going to be a gap period between the time they come back to school and then before they get their vaccinations. So it's not going to be 100% with the schools. But fortunately, children are not quite as vulnerable to the complications of this, but they still can get sick. They can still have complications. So we're not out of the woods yet.
We've been speaking with Dr. Jim Lomax. We call him Dr. Jim because he's our resident doctor. He's also a longtime volunteer, former president of the Board of Trustees for WJFF. And he's been giving us updates all throughout the pandemic. And Jim, what is it about keeping the community connected, especially about this health issue that's meaningful to you?
Well, I think as a healthcare professional, the fact that there has been a source of consistent and truthful information being broadcast since when would you start?
I think it was March 13th, as I recall.
Right. But
I think when we started our last spring pledge drive, or we tried to.
Little did we realize.
Little did we know.
But the fact that the WJFF has been a source of information and a way of communicating to large numbers of people, I think that's really an important thing. And again, the people that you brought on for interviews have been the best in their field. And so people were getting the right information, not a skewed look at something or misinformation that was so prevalent, particularly before November. So I think, that's an important function. But also, you have to remember that WJFS is part of the emergency broadcasting system of this county.
Yep.
And so when things go haywire, schools are closed, if their bridges are out, if there's some kind of natural disaster, we're part of that loop that gets that information out for people. So I think that the station has a lot to be proud of. But again, it takes money to run us.
Yes. And, and our listeners have been so supportive over the past year, especially. And we still need that support. We are listener-supported public radio. And you can support us with a donation during our spring fund drive. Go to WJFFradio.org and click the donate button and make a gift of any amount. Any amount will do. Gets us toward our goal. Or you can give me a call here this morning if you want, 845-482-4141. I can juggle the phones. Jim, anything else you want to let people know about why it's important to keep the community connected to WJFF?
Well, I think what probably the public doesn't know the full extent of it, but we've been working so hard to get ready for a new station house, which was going to be better technology, but clearer signals, and so I think, you know, we're, even though it's been a very, very tough year financially, we've been proceeding on that track too, and doing a good job again with the generosity of so many people in our community. So we have a lot to be proud of. And again, we're going to be around for another 30 years, but it takes a lot of work and a lot of generosity from our listening public.
When we've been promoting the Spring Fund Drive, we've been trying to remind people to think about the programs that they love and think about the voices they listen to and think about how you listen to WJFF during your day and how vital that is to as a part of your life. And if you want to support that, we'll take your support. We can use your support. Go to WJFFradio.org and make a donation to our Spring Fund Drive or call 845-482-4141. Jim, thank you so much. Dr. Jim Lomax, we appreciate the update and appreciate you being my pitch buddy this morning.
Good. You take care. And again, you know, we're all in this together, and we'll get through it together too. So,
thanks, Dr. Jim. Be safe.
Take care now.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and we are in the midst of our spring fund drive here at WJFF. Go to WJFFradio.org and donate. I've got another pitch buddy on the line. It is Leif Johansson joining me again. Leif, hello.
Good morning, Tim. Good to be here again.
Thanks for joining us. We've got all kinds of folks helping support this morning. And you just heard from our very own Dr. Jim Lomax with the COVID-19 update. We're going to talk, we're going to hear from you in an excerpt from your podcast in just a second. But can you remind folks about why it's important to donate and why we're doing this?
Oh, I'd be more than happy to. So WJFF truly is your community radio station, right? It kind of embodies so many of the different ideas and thoughts and music preferences and all of this stuff that exists in our community. And so it's so fun that we get to all come together through this radio station and showcase all this different material from you know, all walks of life and all over the place right here in the Catskills and in Northeast Pennsylvania. So, you know, if you support listening to each other and connecting with other people in your community, donate to WJFF today. You can go to WJFFradio.org.
Yeah. Earlier I had said you can call 845-482-4141 and I can juggle the phones, but someone just called and I was about to go on air with you. So give me a second, but you can call too and I'll make it work. It's just that timing was like right when I was coming on air with you. So I want to make sure that folks know that, you're a host of our podcast, your podcast on our website, WJFFradio.org, called Close to Home. You know, podcasting is taking over the world, but it's fairly new to us here. Thanks to folks like you and your podcast, and you were here last hour and told folks, but in case they weren't listening to last hour, let folks know about your podcast and what you're doing.
So the idea behind Close to Home is to kind of take apart some of the institutions that exist within our community and kind of figure out how different things are working and what makes them work and the characters behind these different processes and institutions that kind of makes our community run pretty seamlessly. And so when there's weird shocks to the system like we had with COVID-19, and all of a sudden our grocery store shelves are empty and maybe our deliveries aren't showing up on time and all this stuff, it kind of makes you think, wow, how does all this stuff really work? And so that's what we try to do in the podcast. And we try to kind of just get a deeper sense of what it means to exist in a community and what it means to be a part of a community where we truly all do rely on each other just for little things to work on a day-to-day basis, such as we'll get to in this episode, our garbage. And that's what this trash talk episode is all about.
We've been teasing. It's talking trash. So give us a little sort of set it up, and then we'll play an excerpt from it.
Okay. So, you know, when we throw out our garbage, and maybe you take it to the transfer station, maybe you, just put your garbage bins outside your house and someone collects them for us, that is the absolute end of it. Because garbage is it's literally filth. I mean, it doesn't take up any thought process for us usually. We're done with it and we move on to the next thing. As long as it doesn't smell in our house, that's what matters. But it's, like I was saying, it's one of these systems in our community that we really do rely on, that we need in order to kind of function normally. And so I was curious, what exactly happens to our garbage and where does it go? How does our recycling program work? And if you can believe it, our garbage doesn't end up really anywhere near here. It gets trucked up load by load hundreds of miles away, yeah. Which we'll actually get to. I don't know if it'll be in this.
I think we get a little. Yeah, I think we get a little bit of that. Yeah. So we're going to listen to the excerpt of Leif's latest podcast about recycling. He's also covered other issues like dairy farming. I believe you also talked about the COVID-19 pandemic. You can find that at wjffradio.org, and you can also donate at wjffradio.org. But let's listen to Leif Johansson and Close to Home talking trash.
This week's episode is an introduction to a series that we're going to keep coming back to. The topic is waste, specifically our garbage and recycling. And I know, it's not the most glamorous of policy issues, and realistically, it's not even that unique to our area. But I have a feeling that because it's neither wildly intriguing nor unique at first glance, not much has been done about it for decades. Doesn't it strike you as a little odd that in the age of supercomputers, helicopter drones on Mars, and two-day delivery of virtually anything you'd ever want, we still just take the vast majority of our solid waste and put it in a pile? And that's it. I mean, there's no other processing or decomposition process beyond that. It just goes into a pile. And when that pile gets too big, we put a tarp over it and we call it a day. And yes, there have been some recent marginal improvements to our trash pile making. Since the latter half of the 20th century, there have been federal laws on the books, such as the 1976 Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, that have mandated that landfills have heavy-duty linings underneath them so that chemicals from the compressed trash don't just leach into our soil and our groundwater. But there is still a surprising lack of system overhaul here. It's still just a pile. A lot of our stuff can be recycled, but as we'll hear today, probably not as much as you think, and for things that can be recycled, well, we don't always do a great job of doing it properly. For a bit of local background on this issue, our garbage and recycling here in Sullivan County is collected either by private contractors that pick it up from our individual homes, or you can elect to bring it to one of six transfer stations across the county. All of it, at the end of the day, ends up at the County Transfer Station and Materials Recovery Facility in Monticello. That's where the Sullivan County landfill is, which reached its maximum capacity more than a decade ago. So if you drive past it now as Broadway turns into Old Route 17 heading out of Monticello, it looks like a small and somewhat unnatural mountain. So what happens to our garbage now?
Much of what we produce is shipped long distances for final disposal. And that creates, of course, an impact on greenhouse gas emissions, fuel consumption, wear and tear on roadways, wear and tear on heavy equipment, and certainly the noise impacts of moving that material through communities as well.
That's Bill Cutler, the Sullivan County Recycling Coordinator. He's been talking trash, as it were, for a long time.
Began this career in 1990, of all things, and I've been with the county since then. Basically, recycling coordinators are tasked with everything from marketing recyclables to educational programs. Communications are key. even to things that don't seem to make a lot of connection necessarily to recycling and materials management, making sure our computer systems are talking together and information flows. So it's a bunch of things, including report writing, grant writing, and good stuff like that.
I'm curious what some of the biggest changes are you've seen in our recycling and waste system in the county since 1990 when you started working on this.
There's really been several changes, both in the industry and in local disposal options as well. Landfill capacity has remained, believe it or not, fairly constant, but the accessibility of that capacity has moved farther and farther away from the points of generation, especially in New York State. Once upon a time, every small community had its own, what we called in the back in the old days, dumps, which were essentially unregulated, unmanaged piles of waste that were pretty much left in exposure to the environment. Since the 1980s, New York State enacted very stringent landfill regulations called Part 360 regulations, and federal guidelines as well kicked in about the same time. Those are called Subtitle D requirements. And that pretty much set the ground rules for how landfills in the future would operate. It both increases costs and complexities on communities to operate those safe and sanitary facilities, but it does also ensure that those facilities will be well managed and will not be prone to leaks. And if they do leak, there's means of stopping those leaks and remediating any damage or harm to the environment that's done. Likewise, in recycling worlds, the lack and distance of market access for ways of managing recyclables have changed as well. Many products that we consume here in North America, for instance, are made overseas. And to truly be recyclable or be recycled, those waste components that when we're done with an item or a good, that material has to go back to the point of creation where that original material or thing was made to be recycled. And that's been a big change because we at one point used to make our own, say, glass bottles fairly locally. The closest glass plant here in Sullivan or near Sullivan County was down near Maybrook, New York, in Orange County. And those smaller glass plants and scrap metal facilities, et cetera, have largely been consolidated. And it means that those raw materials have to be shipped much greater distances to be marketed and then recovered. If you don't have a market, you can't really recycle something. That's been a very big change we've seen as well. So essentially, recycling programs have kind of matured to the point where they become collection points, consolidation points for spent recyclables. And programs like ours then work with the private sector to find ways to ship those back, get them back to a company that specializes and turning that now glass, broken glass cullet in many cases back into new glass bottles that consumers can use again. Once upon a time, the idea of a glass bottle as a reusable instrument was a much easier and straightforward and more energy efficient container. When I was a kid, talking many, many generations ago here, it seems, glass bottles were reusable rather than recyclable. They could be refilled, sterilized, cleaned, and, a new cap or container label put on and shipped back to a consumer. Milk was often transacted that way. Soda pop and other materials as well were done that way.
So did we just move away from that model where something like a glass bottle will get reused over and over and over again just with after being cleaned out and throwing a new cap on it? Just because it's so much cheaper now just to create endlessly new glass bottles?
That's a very good question. It comes down not only to a matter of cost, but of convenience. Over the years, we've become very accustomed to having things very convenient and at our fingertips. And I think perhaps markets were looking at a quick way of packaging something and then not needing to have to necessarily deal with the container once the contents were purchased by the consumer and utilized. It became a single use or an end use for that package. So the consumer would buy the product, consume the contents, and then the consumer would then manage the end use or the end disposal site for that spent container. if the consumer had to rinse the container out and then find a way to get it back to, let's say, a milk plant or something of that sort for refilling, I think there was at least an implication that that was less convenient than simply discarding the spent container and then purchasing a new one. So it's been a very subtle change that I've seen, subtle steps for slight convenience increase or increase in convenience, yet a much greater waste product resulting from that.
So I'm getting into the topic of how our recycling system on the county level works. It seems like a system like single stream recycling is kind of based around that same idea of how can we make this as convenient as possible to the consumer who is creating this waste once they're done with these, often kind of single use items. So how does that single stream system work?
So many counties like Sullivan have fairly complex arrangements for collecting and then consolidating materials and finding them or finding a way to get them back to a place that would take them. In Sullivan County's case, our county spread out of over about 1,000 square miles. And Sullivan County operates a hub and spokes solid waste management program consisting of a central facility in Monticello, New York, that has three closed capped landfills on site, a stormwater treatment plant, a leachate collection and treatment facility, a gas management facility, as well as an export facility and a paper recycling center designed specifically to accept both waste and single stream recyclables back into the export capacity of the building and sorted paper types, cardboard, newsprint, mixed paper, in our paper recycling facility. So that sounds like a lot, right? It essentially means that garbage goes to one place in a building where it's then transferred to tractor trailers and shipped up to Seneca Meadows Landfill in upstate New York for disposal. And on the other half of the building, single stream recyclables are collected. And again, that's kind of a tip and ship operation. Single stream recyclables are collected by our private hauling community in Sullivan County, who offer the curbside collection, convenient pickup of single stream recyclables and waste from customers, as well as those six county transfer stations that are arrayed around the county. And we provide the trucking and transfer for materials from all of our county facilities, plus two town stations as well. So the amount of travel that materials undergo to get to the point or from the point of disposal to our point of recollection and then marketing is pretty extensive. The single stream recyclables in our program, once brought to our central facility in Monticello, are transferred to Beacon, New York, to a Republic Waste single stream MRF or materials recovery facility. That facility is unique because it goes beyond just accepting source separated or consumer separated recyclables for recovery. It specializes in taking apart a whole mix of all types of containers and packages through a semi-automated system, developing separate piles of each of the valuable subcomponents in that single stream recycling mix, if you will, and then finding markets globally for those materials. So it is very complex, and there are many market dynamics that affect supply and demand, obviously, and value of those materials in the single stream program. To have a really well-administered single stream program, you kind of have to set some basic ground rules at the start, which means maybe the recipe of what you will accept as single stream recyclables coming in from the public. And in our case, it's number one through number seven plastic bottles and containers. They do have to be 5 gallons in size or smaller, completely clean. They do have to be empty, no liquids trapped inside. Caps should be removed. Caps, if they're not metal, should be disposed of. If there's any residue or contents, that container, if it can't be cleaned, should be thrown away as garbage rather than be recycled. Likewise, in single stream, glass bottles are accepted as well. They need to be empty and clean. Labels can remain on. Metal containers, both aluminum cans and steel cans, clean and empty, are accepted in single stream. And single stream goes a step further. It also accepts things like corrugated cardboard, mixed office paper, magazines, junk mail, telephone directories are accepted, and newsprint. And that's a very if you think about it from a convenience standpoint, it's a very convenient mix of just throwing everything in a pile, if as long as it's clean, well-designated single-stream material. And that material then gets transferred to a facility that can then resort out all those components that make up the single-stream mix or recipe and market those materials. So it takes a lot of the legwork of hauling just a container of cardboard or just a container of number one plastic or just a container of clear glass out of the municipal realm that we once did, and it transfers it back to the private sector. They've got the specialization and tools and facilities necessary to divvy up those subcomponents in the single stream mix and then market them. And once they're marketed, the industries can transfer those back to the points of manufacture where they need to go to be turned into new things.
So if my understanding is correct, then you're saying that the only difference between single stream recycling and multi-stream recycling is that rather than us sorting our own recycling much of the time, unless we're sorting it out at a transfer station, someone else is doing the sorting. At one point or another, it's just changing the point where the sorting happens, right?
Yes, exactly.
And that sorting doesn't happen at the facility in Monticello. That all that sorting just happens in Beacon?
It does. It does. Our single stream facility here in Monticello is really just a tip and chip operation. It's a consolidation point.
Got it.
We no longer have the staff necessary to process those sorted recyclables into different categories. And instead, it's commingled in a box and transferred to a company that can do it. And that company will then, depending on the economics of the material in that box, if recyclables are up in value, as they're starting to become now, we will see either lower costs to discharge those recyclables to the company, or we may even see a positive revenue stream in the future as recycling markets rebound and material markets increase in value. So it's a sliding scale. If things are costly, we're going to have to pay to have our single stream processed. And if economics are good, if the value of those recyclables in the box are high, we're going to see a check or a revenue stream from those materials that we do recycle. It's really kind of unique because in government, we're the only program I'm aware of that actually buys and sells commodities into the global recovery market. So we make a product and we sell it worldwide.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and that was Leif Johansson, an excerpt from his podcast at WJFFradio.org, Close to Home. Leif's joining me now. Leif, fascinating. There's more to that episode, but it really makes you think about what you're throwing away or what you think you're recycling.
Oh, my gosh. I think the kind of word of the day when it comes to this system that we're talking about in this episode is interconnectedness, where, you know, we completely rely in Sullivan County on this facility way down in Beacon, a couple counties away, to just sort all of our recycling out and to send it off where it needs to go. And so later in the episode, Bill Cutler gets to talking about some like paper plants that are opening further upstate in New York. There's, you know, a greater demand for something like a glass plant, or with if there's a big infrastructure bill coming out soon, that would mean that the whole market for recycled steel changes. And so all of this stuff, when it gets sorted out, needs to go all over the place, and depending on what the market is looking like and what is needed where and when around the world, the prices of all this stuff changes. And that actually affects us in Sullivan County, because the prices that are, you know, we're getting for recycling at the county level, that revenue, if there is revenue, is coming back to the county, and that can then affect how much money we need to pay to the county through our taxes.
Right.
So all of this stuff is connected, and it goes even further than that, where something like there's a policy in China that was enacted in 2018, and then it was kind of reinforced this year in 2021, that banned the imports to China of most of our recycled material. And it's because a lot of the stuff we were giving them was of very mediocre quality, and it kind of needed to be thrown out.
Yeah.
And so them banning our recycling over there means that the whole market for us here changes. So it's really that kind of interconnected local to global connection. And there's just so many elements at play after we, you know, take out our garbage bins and put them next to the road.
Yeah, and you obviously you're passionate about it and passionate about the what you do. And if you support what Leif is doing, go to our website. You can hear that podcast, but you can also donate at wjffradio.org. You can also call 845-482-4141. Call 845-482-4141 and make a donation of any amount to our spring fund drive. You know, some people haven't donated yet, Leif. Maybe their first pledge of support, or maybe they thought they did, but maybe it's been a while. Maybe they don't know how listener-supported radio works. Can you tell people, since you're the expert finding out stuff, but how does listener-supported radio work?
So the funny thing is that we're talking about interconnectedness with all this recycling and garbage stuff, but our listener-supported radio kind of works the same way, right, where it connects us all together, but we also all kind of depend on each other, right? So on a daily basis, we kind of depend on getting that local radio, whether it's our news programs, our music programs, or, you know, anything else far and wide and in between to listen to, whether it's on our commute or whether we're sitting at home with a nice cup of coffee. But also, listener-supported radio depends on listeners, the community, in order to be able to do that. So that's all really interconnected, too. And so WJFF has been on the air for, I think, 31 years now, if I have that correct, since 1990. Mm-hmm. And playing 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for 31 years, you can do the math at how many, you know, hours that is that we've been on the air. But in all those hours, not a single ad has ever been played. And that's something that is really important, I know, to me as both a volunteer and a listener, and I'm sure to you as well, Tim, and to all of us, right? That we're not really beholding to anyone, right? We're kind of this independently functioning, community supported, locally run radio station that is able to do all this cool stuff, bringing you national programming and local programming, because we get that support from our community that, you know, knows and loves what we do and wants to be a part of that family. I loved what you were talking about before. We're all kind of this big WJFF family, right? It's a quirky family. It's an eclectic family, but gosh, it's a great family.
Yeah. And if you want to be a part of that family, go ahead. Give them the number.
Oh, I'd be more than happy to. So you can call us up, 845-482-4141. That is a phone number I don't think I'll forget until the day I die, I have to say. Or you can go to our website, donate online, wjffradio.org.
Great. And, you know, you're listening to Radio Chatskill, and one of the things we'd like to do on this show is connect folks to some of the things that are going on in the artistic part of the community. Bethel Woods Center for the Arts is hosting sensory-friendly museum days that create an inclusive and fun museum experience for guests with autism and other complex developmental disabilities. I spoke with creative arts therapist Candace Ravella about the museum's effort to help those with a variety of learning abilities and sensory differences.
So what it entails is an early morning opening, so prior to the regular museum hours. We open the doors for, like you said, guests with autism and other complex conditions. And what we've done is altered the museum and augmented the sound and lighting features to allow for a more enjoyable experience and to reduce sensory stimulation.
And that's important because people with autism, they can have sensory issues that involve hypersensitivity, that involve sights and sounds and touch and body awareness. So it's really important for them to find a safe space, right?
Yeah, exactly. And especially when you're in a public space like a museum where there's potentially, you know, many visitors at once, and there are also, you know, potentially areas of high stimulation like noisy spaces or dark spaces or bright spaces, you know, kind of finding those areas in the museum and just doing a little bit of extra work to kind of reduce some of the stimulation, like I said, by altering the sound or lighting features. And also we have implemented some additional resources and materials to help folks navigate the museum. For example, we have a sensory map that indicates those areas of high stimulation so that, you know, as you enter the museum, you're a little bit more prepared about what you're going to encounter. And we also have a social narrative, which is a tool that we use. It's often used in the autism community. It's basically a write-up that introduces a new social situation and a new environment, and describes kind of in really, in detail the museum environment and highlights some important cues and offers some examples of ways to respond. You know, like, for example, when you enter the museum, you might notice a lot of people in the cafe area, and, you know, and that's okay. You can just bypass the cafe, you know, for example, things like that. That just helps people prepare and know what to expect and kind of encourages some familiarity and comfort with our museum. Mm-hmm.
Why was it important for the museum to make the whole experience accessible to the autism community?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's really our hope that, you know, this program is going to kind of foster some more community connections to Bethel Woods. And, you know, we've always had a commitment to making sure that our concerts and our events and our spaces are accessible. But this is really kind of going the extra mile, taking another step in kind of, you know, just demonstrating our commitment to the public. And, you know, we know that cultural institutions across the world are kind of realizing the importance of building inclusive environments. And we also know that the museum experience itself helps to foster, you know, cognitive development and nurture social connections. And so we just want to make sure that everybody, no matter what age or what ability, has access to that. And we have so many, you know, wonderful things to offer in our museum, and we just want to make sure that everybody can enjoy it.
What's the feedback been like?
The feedback has been really wonderful. This program was actually developed in collaboration with the Center for Discovery and New Hope Community, which are, you know, two of the leading organizations in our local area who are doing this work, you know, day in and day out to support people with autism and other complex developmental disabilities. And so we've gotten wonderful feedback from them. They've been, you know, really important partners in, you know, kind of identifying from the very beginning, and this project started back in 2019, helping us identify the ways that we could augment the experience. And we had, you know, several walkthroughs, and then we had test groups with participants from those centers. And so we feel really confident that what we have in place now is going to be well received. And we've got registration for our first opening day, which is very exciting. And, you know, we also want to make sure that on the days of these events, we're also collecting feedback from the community. That's really important for us as well, to kind of survey and assess, you know, what the experience was like for people, and what did they enjoy about it, and where did they think we could improve. So it's a brand new endeavor, one that we're really, really proud of, and I think that the community will definitely enjoy.
You're a creative arts therapist and the lead teaching artist in museum education and creation programs at Bethel Woods. What are some of the other programs that you're looking to develop, and how have they been influenced by some of the community feedback that you've experienced in other areas?
Right now, we have a program called The Art of Wellness that's going on. And these are creative arts therapy groups in person, small, intimate groups, for teens and adults, which I facilitate, and also I bring in other holistic practitioners and educators to come in as special guests, and teaching art, Bethel Woods teaching artists as well. And that program is, you know, it was kind of born out of the pandemic and was a way to get people, you know, back out of isolation, bring them back together, and kind of introduce some new tools for wellness and self-care and creativity and expression.
I noticed that also for the sensory-friendly museum days, on non-sensory days, you offer copies of the sensory map and the social narrative to encourage more participation. Why is that important?
Yeah, because we really, you know, we are hosting these special days, these early access days on the second Saturday of every month, but we really wanted to make sure that every day of the year that we're open, we are, you know, having resources available for people to be supported in their navigation of the museum if they need it. So having copies of that sensory map and having having the social narrative available online that people can look at in advance to help them prepare was really important to us. So that, you know, you can come any day of the museum and feel comfortable. So, yeah, that's really important. One thing I didn't mention was that we also have, on sensory-friendly days, we also have noise-canceling headphones available and some other fidget items, so other supportive resources for people who might need them to help with sensory stimulation.
Where can folks get more information about the sensory-friendly days and other events that are going on at the Bethel Woods Center for the Arts?
Yeah, all of these events are posted on our website. So you can go on to bethelwoodcenter.org and click on all the various tabs to find out the programs that are going on. You could also register for our Bethel Woods at Home program. You know, you could just register and receive a free link to the curator happy hour. Our marketing team does a really great job of updating our social media accounts, so Facebook and Instagram, also a really great way to get up-to-date information on all the happenings.
All right. We've been talking to Candace Ravella, who is the creative arts therapist at Bethel Woods Center for the Arts, also the lead teaching artist in museum education and creation programs. Thank you so much for joining us, Candace.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill, but that's not all for our spring fun drive. It continues. We have a goal of $40,000 to meet by April 24th. We're at about $12,000. Jason Dole's here right now.
Yeah, and I'm waiting for the phone to ring. Give us a call right now at 845-482-4141. Make your contribution. Help us keep the ball going on this spring fun drive.
We want to thank Christine from Summitville, Monica from Livingston Manor, and Mary from right here in Jeffersonville for donating.
Thank you.
Went online and donated at wjffradio.org. That's a really easy way to do it. Or just give us a call, 845-482-4141. I want to thank my pitch buddies for the hour. Earlier, Dr. Jim Lovax.
Yes, and then thank you.
Leif Johansson from his Close to Home podcast. He went back to bed or is discovering more about recycling. And also
either
now,
way, it's a dream.
It is. It's good stuff. Or Jason Dole. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening. Remember, be kind, wear a mask, and stop the spread.
Support comes from Rourke Law, Liberty, New York. A general law practice serving the Catskills and Delaware River Valley with an emphasis on estate planning, estate administration, elder law, and real property matters. RourkeLaw.com.
WJFF Jeffersonville, W233AH Monticello, Radio Catskill, public radio for the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania.
The news, music, and community information you listen to, the voices you rely on, can only be heard on this station thanks to the support of listeners like you. Think about how much it means to have this amazing radio station in your life. Then make your contribution at wjffradio.org. That's WJFFradio.org. Thanks.
Support for Farm and Country comes from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, a community-supported, science-based nonprofit taking legal actions, providing tools for action, and raising awareness of fracking damage since 2008, proactively protecting public health in the Delaware River Basin and beyond. DamascusCitizens.org.